Well, just want to give my appreciation to the organizers of this meeting, and of course to especially to Lars for putting together what's already been such a terrific scientific program, and good food, good company. Bob Kirshner, you just can't beat him. So it's just a pleasure for me to be here, and it's also a great pleasure for me to have the opportunity to tell you just briefly a little bit of work, of the large amount of work that's going on in the Flash Center in the past several years on different kinds of thermonuclear flash phenomena, astrophysics, and of course we've been focusing greatly on, in the last few years, the last 3 years or so, on the type 1A problem, which is so important for cosmology as well as for itself and for nucleosynthesis in the universe, and is also so hard. So I think that there, you know, we are hearing from several teams in the world who are really tackling this problem with absolutely as much energy and knowledge and skill as possible. And I think, as Tomek Pleva said, you know, there's a lot of things, and Wolfgang said too, that we don't yet have control over when we're trying to do the simulations and modeling. So what I'll tell you about is the focus that we've put on a particular mechanism for the type 1A explosions that I wished, as the director of the center, that I could say it was good management, but it was totally a serendipitous discovery of this gravitationally confined detonation mechanism, and want to share with you where we stand on exploring, investigating that mechanism, tell you a little bit about some of the promising features that we see in our 2D and particularly the new 3D simulations that we've done that make it, in our minds, certainly a very promising candidate to continue to be explored as a solution to how type 1A supernovae do indeed explode. I get the pleasure of standing up here and telling you about the results, but actually it's this team here with many, many young people who have done, you know, all the work. And so I just have had this up here from the beginning for a little time. I really would encourage you to talk with them. They can tell you a lot more about the work they're doing, and as was kind of evident on Monday, we did try very much to use this meeting as an opportunity for them to share with you the work that they're doing with a set of 10 poster papers here covering topics from alternative white dwarf merger scenarios for 1As, to the discussions of the smoldering phase numerically, and then work on verification of the flame model that we use, and on issues of the bubbles in supernovae and the requirements for them, the initial conditions that one uses in these simulations to be self-consistent. And moving on then to work on the energy, the nuclear energy release during the flame, and then a really nice parameter study that Dean Townsley did using the new energetics and the new flame model. I'll be featuring here, in fact, the 3D simulations of the deflagration phase, and the detonation criteria come into this, of course, and lead to the simulations of the detonation phase of this GCD model. And lastly, Alexei Polonienko has done a beautiful job with a new moving grid scheme that allows one to follow the supernovae from just the first few seconds out to timescales of many days, even 10 days, and watch the development of the effects of radioactive decay, particularly of nickel, on nickel bubbles and other features, and to some degree to the dynamics. So just as a quick a summary here, what I'll be telling you about will focus, you know, on this set of work of these incredible young people. So what I wanted to tell you about is just briefly that the new things that we're putting into our simulations. We have followed the nuclear flame using a new version of the ADR model that was used we used previously, and it's been used by Vadim Gamitso and Alexei Kokolov in their work. And the new prescription is a so-called KPP form that's not a top hat, it's smooth. We truncate it so that it doesn't have long tails. And the key thing here is this new flame model is numerically much quieter, more stable, and exhibits much smaller curvature effects than the flame model that was previously in use. We've also used a new three-stage treatment of nuclear burning that includes neutronization and the evolution of the NSC state as the bubble rises and the density declines. And you can look at the posters for things on all these different things. In what I'll describe to you here, we start with a single ignition point and a quiet background, and we're in the progress of setting up our simulations to do multiple ignition points in a convective background, and we'll be reporting that work later. So one key thing about the way we approach our simulations, and it's similar to what Wolfgang and Fritz and the Munich group do, and that is we really are of necessity have to do large eddy simulations. As everyone here in the audience knows, the nuclear burning scale initially is 10 to the 12th times smaller than the size of the star. And even with the supercomputers we have today, we're a long, long way from being able to do DNS of that nuclear flame. So the advection diffusion reaction model effectively is a subgrid model for the flame. It spreads the flame front out over a few zones, and then that allows us to have good control over its noise and stability and curvature effect properties. And one feature of this is that we have done a work in what we call our astrophysical flame laboratory, a simulation environment, and Zhu Zhang, Tomik Pleva, who's here, Alexei Kokolov, did this work. And what I wanted to illustrate here is this is sort of like the rectangular three-dimensional computational domain we use, and this is for a particular choice of laminar flame speed. This is the calculated surface area at this time. You can see that it's gone from initial perturbations to a fully developed turbulent combustion state here. And the key thing I wanted to call attention to here is that we have done these simulations for a wide range of resolutions. And what we find is that the dominant contribution to the rate of burning comes from the features at the largest scales. And that's shown quantitatively here on the right, where for the same box size and the same laminar flame speed, we see three simulations with increasing resolutions by factors of 2 and then 4, and that the result in the time average sense is that the turbulent flame speed is the same for all three of these resolutions. And this is something that we've seen in a number of other simulations we've done as well. So our picture of it is that the larger features in the turbulent burning account for the majority of the burning rate, and therefore the detailed small-scale subgrid features, if one does one's best, and has high enough resolution where you're resolving the turbulent burning, we think we're capturing the majority of the burning that's going on. So an important issue in that regard is to take a look at what the new nuclear energetics and the new flame model give us in terms of convergence with resolution. And what I'm showing here are three 2D simulations. This is from Dean Townsley's paper with the team, of three different resolutions, and then three 3D simulations with exactly the same resolution, the same initial conditions. And what you can see is that there's really, really good convergence with resolution up through the point here where the flame, the bubble has broken out through the star. And then over the longer periods later, there's still some burning going on in the tail, as you'll see, of where the bubble rises and comes out, not in the material that's flowing over the surface after the bubble pops out. But we need to do a lot more thinking about what is the kind of burning that's going on there. Is it really true that it should be burning still? And is it, you know, what's the right effects there? So, but even so, the differences in the amount of burn mass and the nuclear energy released are quite modest, even at very late times. So we're quite pleased and we're quite happy with the outcome of the work that we did to improve the flame model and the nuclear energetics. And I just, you know, really want to mention this as well, that when we're talking about the results that, that Fritz described earlier today and that Wolfgang described yesterday, it really does matter the degree to which one can achieve convergence with resolution. I would say that just because you have convergence doesn't mean for sure you converge to the right physical solution, and this is something that only comparisons with experiments and with observations can help us to make sure to do. But if you don't have convergence with resolution, then it's really hard to know what it is that your simulation is actually telling you. And in the bubble situation, I comment that this is probably the most difficult demanding situation because of the geometry, both the spherical geometry at the beginning, the bubble shape is growing, and it only burns a small fraction of the star, so there's a lot of headroom if you don't have different flame models that you burn different amounts. For a central ignition or multiple ignitions distributed around the center of a star, you have that's not so sensitive. The early laminar phase will merge and burn out some significant amount of the mass, and the topology is not as difficult in terms of spherical geometry as it is in the beginning with the bubble. So this is some concern, certainly to me and to our team, that in the less demanding situation of central ignition that's been published here, the with resolution, the amount of nuclear energy that's released or the burn mass is actually not converging here at these late times. This is up to this point, it's actually diverging with resolution. So when we try to compare our results with these results, it makes it a little challenging to know what is the target we're aiming at. So I wanted now to turn to showing you a couple of movies. I have several more, but I'll show you two of them. And this was a particular choice of initial conditions, a bubble, single bubble offset, 100 kilometers. 25 kilometers radius, which is just barely or slightly not physically self-consistent in terms of when you think about the initial conditions and you have a bubble of a certain size, we think that the ignition region is probably of the order, we don't know for sure, but of the order of a few kilometers or so, certainly much smaller than 50 kilometer bubbles, or 25 probably. And therefore, when we start a simulation with such a bubble, we have to realize that the bubble started somewhere else and buoyantly moved to there while it was growing, so it will actually have some velocity. And also, if we start too far out, it will be immediately Rayleigh-Taylor unstable and will be catching up, whereas it should have gone Rayleigh-Taylor unstable earlier. And so you can never converge to the real solution, and so the self-similarity is lost. But Okay, I'll move right along. So what I'm showing you here is a simulation, and what you're seeing here is the initial bubble in laminar burning, then going Rayleigh-Taylor unstable, and what you're seeing here is the flame surface. So that's defining the volume. It breaks out through the surface here. It'll rotate so that you can see it. And then... will come out further so you can see it flow over the surface and surround the bubble. On my computer it runs smoothly, but I guess connected here it's not as smooth. So you can see the flow converge to the point on the other side of the star, and you can see the trail that's right up the middle a little bit there. It will now flow over the surface and collide. Okay, so what I'll show you now is a second movie of the same simulation, which shows you the surface of the star and the temperature. So here's the temperature on this color scale, and here's the density, And so you'll see the same phenomenon, but this is picked out to show temperatures in excess of 1 to 2 times 10 to the 9th degrees, and this is the surface here is focused right on 1 to 2 times 10 to the 7th grams per cubic centimeter. So this is really the surface where if the temperatures are above a couple times 10 to the 9th and the material at that temperature has penetrated this surface, then robust conditions, I mean quite conservative conditions for detonation are reached. And so you can see that there's waves of material that flow over the star, and then we'll come in a moment here after it rotates and look close up on the collision region at the southern pole of the star. So the collision has caused the material here to be compressed to high temperatures, but not to such high densities, only 5 times 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 6th, a few times 10 to the 6th. But the collision has caused an outward-directed jet, even 30,000 kilometers a second, and an inward-directed jet, which punches into the surface layers of the star. And you can see that it's penetrated substantially this density that's of 1.5 times 10 to the 7th grams per cubic centimeter and at high temperatures. And so that's the region that you see coming around here, that where the detonation we find conditions are easily and robustly created. So this is a close-up slice of it to show you with the contours of density, which are hard to see, but this is a couple times 10 to the 7th and 10 to the 7th through here. So it's the inward directed jet that triggers the conditions that are robust for detonation. And this shows you the nuclear energy released, both in terms of two models with different initial conditions and with different resolutions. And again, you see the excellent convergence with resolution here. On this side, we are exploring different offsets. And then in these last two cases, different bubble initial radii. And what you see is a nice family of curves here as you go from 20 to 40 to 100 kilometer offset. But when you get to bubble radii in the beginning larger than 16, say 25 or 50, you see that those aren't fully self-consistent initial conditions, and you lose this self-similarity. All of these simulations we find to detonate robustly. And an issue which we should be thinking about, and certainly has already been discussed by previous speakers, including Ellie Livni and Wolfgang, Fritz certainly, and that is the flame model. And I think this figure, which this plot comes directly from Fritz and Wolfgang's and Stan's paper, is important because, and it's a very nice thing. It, to the degree that the extreme conditions needed for detonation to be achieved depends on less or more pre-expansion, that is, if there's more pre-expansion, more nuclear energy released, more pre-expansion, then the flow over the surface may be slower and the collision less violent, then the nuclear energy here is a measure of that. And you see, these show from their 2D simulations a clear correlation here. And our 2D simulations, as reported in Townsley et al., lie on this correlation. Our 3D simulations also lie on this correlation, and I just circled them here to make it very clear. So what we find here on this plot, at least as far as we can tell, is that our 3D simulations agree with this relation, as do our 2D, and as do the Repke et al. 2D. But the two single bubble simulations in 3D that were not found to detonate lie significantly down in temperature, below what's needed to detonate, and don't agree with the other three sets of simulations or this relation. And we've worked pretty hard to try to figure out why, and we have not been able to, but I look forward to talking with Wolfgang and with Fritz and Stan and so on, and trying to understand why the particular 3D simulations are disparate. So quickly, here's the initiation of the detonation. You can look at Casey Meekin's poster paper. The head of the jet here, very strong, almost shockwave conditions here. Initiation of the detonation. Here you can see it, that it's been launched. And as his poster shows as well, you can see it sweeping across the whole star. And what we also find is important that at the late stages, as the detonation swept across the center of the star, it produces an electron capture hole in the center of the star. And so, at least for some of the offset distances, this is what's going to happen. And there are recent observations and some earlier ones that are suggestive that something like this is being observed. So I'm coming here to the close by saying one of the kind of global promising features that certainly we feel about the confined detonation model is that, as you saw, it leaves almost the entire inner part of the star undisturbed. A bubble goes up, spreads over the surface. The detonation starts at the outside, and the result of this is that it will leave a very uniform composition, very stratified throughout the bulk of the star, with a lot of inhomogeneities and mixing and turbulence in the outermost layers, with even, you know, high iron peak and lots of particularly intermediate mass elements. Whereas in the pure deflagration picture, you expect, as shown here, and this is, you know, for in the particular, these are the different compositions, it's turbulent burning throughout most of the star, so we expect most of the star to be inhomogeneous, mixed, even, but not the surface layers, the kind of the opposite picture. And even in the DDT model, where you detonate when the turbulent burning has gotten to 10 to the 7th degrees, you will, of course, incinerate the material as the detonation wave runs back through, but you will not. You will preserve. And this is something that Chris Girardi and colleagues have pointed out. You will preserve the inhomogeneities in the compositions, particularly of nickel and cobalt in the core. So in a cartoon-like way, and this is my last slide here, is just to show this, that in both the pure deflagration and the DTT models, the compositional structure you kind of expect is turbulently mixed inhomogeneous composition throughout most of the star, but a smooth stratified composition that hadn't been turbulently burned either in the pure deflagration or after the detonation wave goes through, and exactly the opposite here. And the recent observations, both the polarization ones by Li Fan Wang and his colleagues, and that the beautiful Spitzer NIR and mid-IR spectroscopic observations of Chris Girardi and his colleagues seem to indicate this structure that the GCD model naturally produces, and not the structure that both the pure deflagration and the DDT model would be expected to produce. So I'll stop there and leave my conclusions up for the discussion.
Yeah, I just had a comment on the plot you showed, so there's more to that. Namely, not all the 3D simulations we did were done with the bubble initial setup.
Right.
So that's a difference, and therefore you would expect different features to develop, and therefore, of course, the collision could be different because you invoke different perturbations on it. And therefore, comparing all the bubble stuff with these more perturbed initial conditions, so we have used perturbed bubbles, we have used teardrops, and all those go into these models.
Right. So I tried to make sure that I was circling the right points, but if I've circled the incorrect points, please correct me. But I didn't circle these down here, but I think these are the two-sided ones.
That's not a sphere in that.
Okay. Thanks.
Directly to that. So the plot you showed from Wolfram Schmidt was not a resolution study. It was not a validation study of the code. What we wanted to show there was actually that the initial, if you don't put in by hand initial perturbations, but let them grow from numerical noise, how they would affect the outcome. So this actually shows that if you put something unperturbed on your grid and let it go, the net outcome will depend on your resolution. And if you put in some perturbation that is sufficiently large, larger than your grid resolution by hand, then you get numerical convergence. So this exactly shows that it's very dangerous to put in a single blob. Don't perturb it. Let just the perturbations grow. They will grow from numerical noise. And the kind of perturbations, the growth rate of those perturbations, will depend on your numerical resolution. that has been studied here. It's not an, any plot that has to do with the validation of the code.
So if I could respond to that, Wolfgang, I would say that you can interpret it and correctly as you did in terms of showing the sensitivity of the simulations to starting with smooth initial conditions. But it does show that there is not convergence for that particular initial case.
Sorry.
And if I could just finish my response, and then please be happy.
One more then.
So if you try to overcome this lack of convergence with resolution by starting out with a larger initial perturbation, since these are large eddy simulations, you will imprint that, and they will not fully be lost.
Sorry, is it a complete misunderstanding of your side what hyperbolic partial differential equations are? If you are initial value problems, if you change your initial values, you should get different results. And the way, if the initial conditions are set by your resolution, that's not a convergence study. You should start from the same initial conditions. You have to set them by hand, then you can do a convergence study. If you don't use the same initial conditions, and you don't use it because you're completely dominated by numerical noise in that case, you don't solve the same problem, and you shouldn't expect to find convergence.
Well, you showed that there's this jet, this outward moving jet with 30,000 kilometers. How much mass is in that jet? And my question is, does that provide any observational signature either in an extragalactic supernova or in a galactic supernova remnant?
Yeah. So we have not yet had time to look into this. I think the amount of mass in it is probably rather modest. But the key thing is how much energy is in it, because it will strike circumstellar material at some distance, and like a snowplow, will snowplow that up as it happens in the gamma ray burst jets. So the question is how much energy, and we're studying that now, because it might become evident and visible if there's enough energy so that indeed, and over this small cone, that you snowplow up enough of the material that's out there. And of course it will start slowing down when the energy in the jet equals the mass energy in the material that's swept up.
Yeah, it's very important to understand the differences between these two studies that you've described. And most of the difference seems to originate from a regime we would think would be well in hand, namely burning in the flamelit regime while the blob is rising. And you showed a plot that was very intriguing. It's the first time I'd seen it. That your 2D and 3D results gave about the same answer. And so I was wondering, would I imply correctly from that you burn the same amount of material in the rise phase in the 2D calculation and the 3D calculation? In which case the question would become a simple one: should burning be more in 3D than it is in 2D?
Yeah. Here's the plot that you're referring to, Oh, okay, but this compares 2 and 3D directly, so it's probably will do the trick. Yeah, so the answer is that we do find close correspondence through the bubble rise and breakout in the 2D and 3D in terms of burn mass, of course taking into account that one is 2D cylindrical, and so we have to, have to extrapolate to the 3D. This, I think, in our view, goes along with the picture that the largest scale features in the burning that happens in the top of the bubble and then becomes turbulent is dominating the burning rate. And so the 2D can lead to different amounts of burning if that were not the case. Yeah.
We have a question over
here. Right. But that's a very important point. And unlike if my understanding of the Munich group's sophisticated model is correct, since you do take information from the resolved turbulence scales and feed it into the sophisticated parameters, then as I think has been said earlier in the week, but certainly I think is true, you will expect in that picture to get different amounts of burning in 2 and 3D. In the ADR model, we do not have a coupling between the resolved turbulence and the flame, and so we would expect not to see a difference.
Don, I was just curious, do you have any sense of how robust this model is if you break the symmetry of your initial star by rotation or tidal distortion? Are you still going to get the convergence you need?
So with rotation, I have absolutely no idea. And, you know, Jens Niemeyer has done an interesting study of what some of the effects of rotation may be. I think we are some cycles, some part of Moore's law, some part of our imaginations away from being able to do that. But what I can tell you is that for the set of initial conditions that we investigated, which ranged over the range of offset distances, which are physically self-consistent, we've found robust detonation. We also took the simulations that we did and deresolved a cone or even the lower half plane from 4 kilometers to 6 to 8 to 16 to 32, and in all cases we saw robust conditions for detonation achieved. So we wanted to understand the resolution sensitivities, and they're you know, it's very robust from that point of view.
One last question.
I mean, let me be clear. In the collision region, you know, if we were to do such poor resolution on the bubble rise and burning, I fear what the outcome would be. I think that would be not good.
You mentioned the formation of the nickel hole due to the electron capture, which is very important to compare with the observation. Do you have how much mass is included in that hole?
These results are very new, and so I'm not really quite confident, but I know that we were, Casey Meekin and Cal Jordan and I were making some estimates, and I believe it's it could be something like 5 to 10%, something like that. I would just comment in that regard is that if there's more pre-expansion, of course, then the nickel hole will go away. And on the other hand, when we took this 50-kilometer bubble, which is not physical, it's way too big, but might be what crudely would happen if you had two or three, five, half dozen ignition points that then burned for a while and merged, we had a much larger burned mass in E-nuke, and it still detonated. But in that case, there wouldn't be any nickel hole at all.
Don, we have to close this up. Thank you very much. Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you.